welcome to the Last Horror Podcast. My name's Christopher Brown. So I was going to do an episode about Philippines, mainly because when I was doing the History Horror Podcast, I didn't really touch a lot on the Philippines. It's as an industry, it's quite contained and insular. Not many films got foreign distribution, even though it was a relatively prolific area. Now, that comes with problems because, you need to watch some of these films to get a feel for it, but there is a documentary called Machete Maidens, and I thought, brilliant, I can watch that, it can tell me where to go, I can probably source some of this stuff, and I can create a reasonably nice 45-minute podcast, hopefully. Anyway, Machete Maidens is not that documentary. It's effectively just about the films that Roger Corman made in, through the 60s and 70s, I suppose. And, with a big focus on, The Big Bird Cage with Jack Hill directing that film that kind of kick-started Pangria's career. Anyway, so I'm watching it and it becomes pretty clear that this isn't really about the Philippines film industry at all. It's another version of, documentary American Grindhouse, kind of music, and then, pictures of, naked women and people getting stabbed and shot, and then talking heads, talking about what a crazy time it was. So you got Joe Dante in there, and Corman, and Pam Grier pops up, and loads of the actors and actresses, Sid Haig's in there, all talking about this wild time they had when they went to the Philippines and made all these films. But half an hour in, it starts talking about the fact that the films are very obsessed with women, unsurprisingly, because that's how you get, teenage boys' bums on seats. And that they portray strong women. Pam Grier is a classic example of an actress who's made a career out of playing very strong, powerful women. And I'm watching, this is interesting. I don't think there's enough here for a podcast, but it's it's an interesting thing to watch, in terms of how people, how that's seen at the time from the actors and actresses and the concepts behind it. Anyway, all of a sudden, John Landis pops up, and he pops up a few times in a kind of giving a slightly different take, maybe an opposing take to what other people are saying. And it kind of stopped me a bit in my tracks. So I'm going to play about a minute and a half of that chat. So you got an idea.
One of the things that made these films noteworthy was the fact that very few people were making films with women leads.
Roger treated women in film really as heroes, and that was a departure.
Moviegoers were not used to seeing women doing action at all.
And even if they're little mousy girls at the beginning, by the end they're toting two machine guns and shooting down with scads of guys.
Female guerrillas.
Machete maiden action.
You not only had a female heroine, but you also had a female being abused. So you got both sides of the coin, and you appealed to the male audience, and you appealed to any dates they may have had to bring, which I suspect were not many.
Is that to get your kicks?
There are a lot of filmmakers who are responsible filmmakers. But sometimes what's fun are the irresponsible filmmakers who later say, well, of course I was doing this.
They were about women being abused at the beginning, but then taking over and having revenge.
I think that was very helpful overall in terms of women establishing themselves on the screen as powerful figures and being empowered as women.
Women really related to that and began to love us as heroes.
You hear people talking about the crassest, most exploitive, sexist, racist films as liberating and intelligent. And I'm thinking, what are they smoking? I mean, what?
You can't rape me. I like sex.
Feminism and women taking their power was worldwide at that time. So taking off our tops was kind of a powerful thing to do.
It was, to a certain extent, liberating.
Look, I can do this, and I can still be an actress, and I can still be respectable.
It's an interesting mixture of feminism, because there we were being exploited in a certain way. And at the same time, we were showing that we were powerful women.
They took control, but they'll show you their tits.
So, yeah, I bet you John Landis are fun at dinner parties. And it just got me thinking, because, I mean, you know, let's give the man the benefit of the doubt that like, he was, you know, being deliberately explosive, and it's a very short clip in what was obviously a very long interview. And it's been put in there at a very particular point. In fact, it's put in, you know, they do that a couple of times with Landis, that he'll say, you know, yeah, but it's just trash, isn't it? And then they'll cut to, you know, come, as he did in this bit, kind of saying, well, actually, it's kind of interesting what was happening at the time. And it's very, I mean, that is very dismissive. And it's a prop, but at the same time, yeah, I mean, the Big Bear Cage and films coming out of that, from that stable of movies at that point, were quite, you know, quite strong and fairly unpleasant at points. So, you know, you've got, I mean, there was a lot of, as I said, there's a lot of voices in that, in those clips, but, you know, you've got Andrea Kagan, Margaret Markov, Lenore Kasdorf in there, all kind of saying, you know, from my point of view, this was a liberating experience. It was a time of you know, a wave of feminism. And this is how I saw my experiences there. And then Landis just goes, tits. So, yeah, I was thought, but if that's the case, I mean, apart from the fact that that's fairly, even in the editing suite, when the director, you know, the documentary filmmakers who were, what is Mark Hartley, who did Not Quite Hollywood, the Ozploitation doco, and the Canon One Electric Boogaloo. You know, that as a form thing is obviously kind of has its, you know, he knows what he's doing. He's making a statement there. And I don't know if that statement is, Landis is a bit of a prick, I'm not sure. But, you know, it's very dismissive of somebody's experiences at the time. And I know there's elements of nostalgia and stuff like that, but nonetheless. But, I mean, dialing it even further back. I mean, the very nature of critique is the fact that you can say a piece of art has elements of its time, that it's important and it does these certain things, regardless of what the filmmaker's actually intended. You know, all art is a product of a very particular set of people at a very particular set place, and particularly with film, where there's lots of different voices all at the same time. And those voices and those opinions come together to create a piece of art, and that is reflective of a societal construct. So you can turn around and say, you know, the Big Bear Cage or Caged Women are, you know, exploitative trash, which, you know, it's a bit harsh, but, you know, you're more than welcome to. But you have to also accept the fact that, you know, they come from a certain place. You could equally argue the fact that creating art and a film where women are in cages and is aggressive and potentially quite misogynistic can also be an indication that of a rebellion, of, you know, a subconscious attack on elements of feminism, the women's movement at that point. It doesn't necessarily have to be a positive thing. It can be a negative thing, but still illustrates the world around it at that time. Now, maybe Landis was saying that, or maybe when he thinks about these films, he just thinks about women's tits. I don't know. But I do think that if we're going to go down that road and kind of say, well, I'm sorry, lads, but in my mind, this was just to sell to teenage boys. Therefore, there is no point in putting it any kind of social framework, any kind of information, any kind of situation around the wider world around it, if it is effectively a pulp to the point of just being disposable. Apart from the fact that, you know, you can create a documentary, just fill it with gore and violence, gore and tits, and kind of sell it that way. You know, they're fitting that. And I think, you know, my feelings on a lot of those documentaries we're talking about is that the kind of one's very good, I think. But, you know, when I watched Machete Maidens, I was a bit like, why are we doing this? Why aren't we doing, like, a wider Corman thing? Would it be too much for one film? Or, you know, is it more to do with the fact that we're basically just taking loads and loads of money shot style-y scenes and put them together. I mean, the thing about that clip was when they talk about the feminism stuff, you see all these tops getting ripped open from these women. Like, it's like a smash cut almost of them. A super cut, I should say. And I, yeah, that ain't, you know, what you say when you're doing that. And kids, filmmakers are, you know, definitely trying to make some kind of point, but I'm not convinced it's the point that they possibly want it to be. And is that documentary as exploitative, therefore, as the films that it's critiquing, or not even critiquing, really giving it a brief history of? And I suppose, yeah. There's something very cool about grindhouse, you know, films, unexploitation films, generally. And a part of that is the fact that it's all a bit no holds barred, over the top. I can't believe they got away with this stuff. And that makes them exciting. But I don't think we can just dismiss those films just as trash. I don't think it's possible to. When we look at exploitation generally, and once again going back to the video nasties, those are exploitation films that had a genuine social impact on the country. And they had a social impact because they were banned, they led to more censorship, and they, you know, they were a way of taking people's liberties away from them, really. You know, this film is so dangerous that it will damage you if you watch it. And it's not me, I'm all right, you know, but there's other people, maybe there's poor people, vulnerable people, as they may be considered. They are almost certainly unable to manage watching this stuff. So when you kind of see like the tacos about it, I think it makes it look like it's a load of fun and a load of silly, sleazy, exciting stuff. It can seem quite dismissive. Now, I'm not turning around saying all these movies have massive social impact. I'm not turning around and going, you know, oh, I don't know, Mardi Gras Massacre or Blood Feast or, you know, hugely important to the social fabric of Britain. But what I am saying is they can't just be dismissed. And particularly not in a way that Landis said. I think the reason for that is that, obviously the films do have some artistic merit. They're not without any merit at all. And also they are, you know, those Philippine films, you know, The Big Bear Cage was influential, is influential now. And they did have strong women, regardless of the exploitative settings that surrounded the film. And it's a reductive, zero-sum game, because in the end, all things can be reduced to, yes, but they're just, you know, whether that be, you know, novels you know, a book, isn't it? In the end, how many people have read this? Who really cares? Or a TV program when it's transient, or a news article, or a tweet, or you know, anything. Unless it directly affects you, unless it's, you know, your particular viewpoint, you'd pretty much dismiss anything, couldn't you? As just being a boring, you know, uneventful, unimportant thing. And I think, you know, particularly with a pop culture that we create around us, I think we need to acknowledge that there is more to the art that surrounds us, because they are, by their very nature, created by the world that exists, you know, the my psychological mindsets. I mean, the big one would be, for example, Wes Craven's Last House on the Left, which, you know, at one point was going to be hardcore porno, was going to be, is a mess in terms of its pacing, tonally really disjointed, you know, it goes from being very grim to having light comedic interludes because he doesn't know really what he's doing. And, yeah, let's fuck it, let's dismiss it. You know, I mean, if we're going to do that argument, it's a poorly put together kind of trashy movie. Except it's not just that, is it? Because it's from its time, it's from, you know, its mindset is quite down. It's a Vietnam War film, effectively, in terms of its outlook and how that society saw the world at that point. It's bleak, it's filled with revenge. And it's obviously taken from as a concept from The Virgin Spring, but it's very much from a very different place. It's kind of like it bubbles up from the swamps of the year that it was filmed in. And it, you know, it paints a bleak picture of where society was at that time. But, you know, it's an exploitation film. So when Margaret Markov says that she thinks her films for Corman in the Philippines were revolutionary acts, or at least reflected a revolutionary time in the women's movement, I don't think that's something you can necessarily dismiss. I think it might be something you can disagree with. And then just to kind of downplay it to the fact it's got topless scenes in is, not nice and very reductive. Generally, not just for discourse, but for the actresses involved. So I suppose what I'm saying is that you can't just dismiss something because you don't think it's very important. But how can we look at these things in a more general way? I think with a lot of, particularly when you're looking at things like exploitation or pornography or horror or anything that's kind of, they're very different things, but anything that possibly is considered to be a little bit trashier, the filmmakers may have considered this stuff, or it may be something that's, you know, bubbling up a little bit more subconsciously. I think time helps, distance helps, definitely. In terms of thinking about, you know, was this the intentions of the filmmaker, or was this something that, you know, can be seen? You know, I think that's also true of horror films with, you know, satirical elements. I think they tend to be easier to spot with a little bit of distance. You know, you kind of see those tropes and trends in the same way. You know, when you're in the middle of a fashion period, it doesn't necessarily look like fashion. It can look like, you know, that's just the way it is, you know. You know, particularly when you're younger, you know, say for the 90s, you know, for me, the 90s at the time felt like a classic kind of fashion period that, you know, it was very, you know, there wasn't a lot there that was kind of, you know, of its time. And then obviously now you look back and everyone's wearing, looks like it's like the gram. It's obvious that was the period of the 90s in terms of fashion. Same with the noughties, you know what I mean? I think, you know, double denim dresses and stuff, that possibly was a bit clear that it was, but there's, you know, the when you look back, you can go, oh, that is definitely that period of time. I can see that from the way the fashion is. And I think that's probably true with, you know, societal or social mores as well. Obviously the stuff that's more clear, you know, so films that cover things that are of that time at that now, and, you know, actual, very, very obvious critiques of society, you know, and I'm thinking in particular with Get Out at the moment. But at the same time, I do think that we will look back on the movies of now and see, I don't know, maybe, you know, distrust in technology, general paranoia, and as I said, you know, recently, that you know, in the episode before last, that, you know, maybe a feel of a lack of control in the world around us. So yeah, I suppose the other side of this is, does this any of this really matter? I suppose it matters in the sense that, you know, it's a good way of understanding the psyche of a people at a certain point. I think, particularly when you're looking at those films that Corman made over in the Philippines at that point. There's two elements. One is the fact they were hugely successful movies, a lot of them, particularly the Big Bear Cage, that Jack Hill film. And the reason for that, you know, probably was it that mix of stuff, you know. It has, you know, strong women, and it's quite sexual, and it's quite violent, and, you know, it is an exploitation film, and there was an appetite for that at that point. Whether those be, you know, an appetite to watch strong women from some of the audience, maybe on the other side of it, you know, a misogynistic backlash to women being, more control of the lives, more powerful, that feminist movement, and wanted to say the flip side of that with on those films, which is women being degraded or tortured or forced stripped, etc. And it can do both, you know what I mean? That film can effectively do both, because what was happening was filmmakers were going out there and they were making a film. Now, regardless of their intentions at that point, it still reflects all those elements and all those swirling thoughts, which I think is where it really kind of annoyed me that Landis just kind of flips them off effectively in terms of, you know, apart from the fact that, you know, you would never, ever dismiss a man's work as his body. Unless, I suppose, I don't know, maybe you would, but not to that extent. Not that broadly. And, you know, and that mindset, I suppose, is the fact that those women are there as a commodity to be naked and to titillate only. And there is no political reason beyond titillation. I think that's specifically where my head fell off. Fuck John Landis on that one. It's a shame because he's always very entertaining when he talks, but I suppose his viewpoint is always that kind of like a, hey, this is trash. Ah, so much fun. Ooh, aren't we reckless? Ugh. Which again, from Landis is, a bit troubling. I suppose this is kind of a rambling way of saying that if you've got a viewpoint on a film or a period of time or an artistry, and it's very easy to dismiss them and for people to dismiss those views. But like any critique, you know, you can stand there, you can fight your corner, you can argue your point, and it isn't for an old man to turn around and just dismiss it out of hand. He may disagree, but never dismiss.
Let's do something dramatic.
It'll be dramatic, all right.
American movies that were shot in the Philippines were basically low-budget drive-in movies.
The crassest, most exploitive, sexist, racist films.
This is Mark F. Stop Fitzgerald. If his camera could talk, he'd be in jail for statutory rape.
They look like they're made on another planet.
We were giving the audience what they wanted to see.
Blood, breasts, and beasts. The three Bs.
The girls with the biggest breasts and the most luscious thighs.
Did I do that? I guess I did.
The Philippines was the Wild East.
You have these movies being made about revolution against fascist dictatorships in a fascist dictatorship.
Who you can talk into the going to the film.
That was the trick.
My agent said, don't you do this movie!
Things were a little tense, but I think it came off all right.
My dressing room was a cave. And guess what else that cave was used for? The men's latrine.
You just want to do the scene, and you want to do it properly, and get out.
Well, I used to think I let all of you pee in my face just to see where it came from, but hell, not anymore.
The people they would get to do the stunts, they would regard as breakables.
Hit them. Kick them. That's what they're paid for.
There, they just put some fuel in the guy and lit him up, and when he got hot, he jumped in the water.
It was hilarious.
The creature they built was a little bit crude.
For $500, what do you want them to do?
They were using real bodies.
Somebody said they were in the refrigerator next to the beer.
You know what?
Brace yourselves for the acclaimed international star, Wang Wang.
Shall we get it on?
Yes, darling, bear your bod.
Let's go!
No, no! I want action!
Human life was cheap. Film was cheap. It was a great place to make a picture.
Never before have you seen material so ripe for masturbation.
Okay, thanks very much for listening. A little bit short, that one. Hopefully you've enjoyed it. It was just something that occurred to me. I really wanted to do this like big Philippines kind of story, you know? Not what was going on, and And like, you know, there's a lot of stuff, the politics of the area and the movies they were making. And there is a fantastic podcast somewhere out there, I'm sure. But, I think I will get there at some point, but it's going to take a lot of time for me to reach it. So I'm not going to rush it. And I was kind of hoping that this Machete Makings was kind of like a fast track, and it's definitely not that. Also, if you want to do a podcast about Roger Corman, you know, do his entire life, you know what I mean? You could do probably 2 to 3 hours on Corman on his own, kind of covering different elements of his career. And at some point, if he ever does properly retire, that would be a good time to do that. So I will go back to Corman. I know that will be one of many people's retrospectives at that point. But I do think it's clear and it's important to get that one right, you know, because he is so pivotal through huge waves of stuff, you know, from those gothic horror, then again, you know, this kind of exploitation stuff, and you know, he's been, you know, and then his more interesting work, you know, the Intruder is a fantastic movie about racism, and you know, he's done a lot of stuff. So let's not just kind of go, let's do this bit. Let's kind of look at more broadly. If you want to get hold of me, please do. My email address is christopher@thelasthorrorpodcast.com. You can go to the website, thelasthorrorpodcast.com, and there's all sorts of bits and bobs on there. And also, you can get me on Twitter @orange_monkey. If you want to support the show, please do. Thank you to Melissa Eisner, who bought me a coffee, and also to Tim Welch, who bought me one as well. You just click on the buy me a coffee button, and you can kind of help contribute to the hosting costs, and you know, keep the show afloat. Next week we're gonna cut. It's been 40 years of 2008. 2008 for me, when I was very young, very very young, was kind of my introduction to comic books. Really, I used to buy, you know, around about the same time I was buying the real Ghostbusters comic book, and there was a stack of 2008s when I was 10 years old, and I worked my way through them, and they were kind of pivotal. And I know a while ago I was talking on a different podcast about Hardware and how good that was, and yeah, it's from a very particular, talking about art, it's from a very particular time. I know 2008 is still going, but it was founded in a very particular independent indies English way, and it continues this day to be subversive and interesting, and 2008 is a fantastic comic. So I wanted to cover that, and we will do next week for Easter weekends. That's an interesting one. There's always the part of me that kind of goes, should we just do something about killer rabbits? But no, not this time. Let's do this instead. So, until then, take care, speak soon.